On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Delighted to say we're joined in studio by Antonista and Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, Leo Varadkar. Antonista, thanks very much. Happy Christmas and happy new year to you and yours. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. We are already completely flooded with questions about COVID-19 and the rollout of the vaccine, and I will come to those in a moment. But because we could talk about that and completely lose all of our time talking about it, I do want to talk to you about the Brexit deal that was struck on Christmas Eve first, the 1,246-page deal that I'm sure you and your advisors are still leafing through. There is a perspective, particularly if you follow the British media, that very little will change now, because Boris Johnson would have you believe that Britain will now be liberated to strike trade deals with all the rest of the world, as the Brexiteers promised, but will still have the luxury of access to the European single market and to a lot of other European projects. It sounds as if it's almost too good to be true, that they have all of the luxuries, all of the benefits, and none of the responsibilities. So maybe you might tell us exactly what the UK is losing out on by leaving.
Well, I suppose, first of all, the most important thing is to look at it from the point of view of Irish citizens and Irish business. And if you go back 4.5 years ago, when the UK decided to leave the European Union, there was a real risk of a hard Brexit, you know, one that could have led to a hard border between North and South, could have led to an end to the common travel area between Britain and Ireland, and everything that flows from that, you know, could have resulted in tariffs on Irish exporters, agri-food sector farmers selling into the UK market, you know, could have resulted in us and our position in the single market being undermined. And, you know, after 4.5 years of diplomacy, we've managed to protect Ireland from all of that. And I think that's significant. And when the history of this period is written, I think a lot of credit will be given to the people involved in that. You know, going back to Enda Kenny, those who followed, our civil servants, our diplomats in Brussels and in Dublin, who've done an amazing job. From the UK's point of view, it does still give them access to the European single market, a market of 400 million people, the biggest and wealthiest market in the world, and they don't have to pay tariffs or quotas either, which is advantageous to them, but it's not unconditional. So what they've agreed to is what we call a level playing field. So have agreed to a non-regression clause in all but name. So we said you can only have access to the market if you don't reduce your standards when it comes to workers' rights, the environment, health and safety, product standards, all of those things. And if they do reduce their standards, or if they don't keep up with our standards, well, then that access to our market could be threatened. So they do still have to largely follow European rules where they're relevant.
So when they talk about the freedom of the lunar pull of the European Union, is that a slight fabrication?
They have their sovereignty. They have the power and authority to deviate from European rules and regulations. But if they do deviate from them too much, well, then they would lose access to the market. And, you know, the truth is, the lunar pull isn't a bad analogy in some ways. You can't get away from the obvious geography that Britain is in Europe, geographically. And, you know, if Europe is the Earth, Britain, which is much smaller, is the moon. There's no way, I think, to take Britain out of Europe. You can take Britain out of the European Union, but you can't take Britain out of Europe. And in reality, you know, when you're beside a massive market surrounded on all sides by it in many ways, you're always going to have to be cognizant of the fact that that market has rules and regulations. It happens in America in a way. You know, California, which is the biggest state, sometimes sets the standards. And even though people making cars in Michigan and South Carolina mightn't want to follow the California rules, when California is the biggest market and that's where the cars are sold, you have to follow those rules. So it's going to be a bit like that. What they won't have a real role in anymore, unfortunately, is in setting those rules. And that's what's a shame in my view, because Britain, you know, Europe is less without Britain in my view.
Okay.
And it's a pity they're gone, but they are gone, and we need to get on with it.
So what is going to change then, no matter what? Because again, there might be a perception that the deal that was struck on Christmas Eve safeguards a lot of the status quo. So what is going to change no matter what anyway? You mentioned, for example, tariffs. Will there still be tariffs on certain products, and there'll still have to be customs declarations even to make sure that you don't have to qualify for tariffs?
Yeah, there won't be tariffs or quotas.
On anything?
Nope. But what there will be is customs procedures. So there's going to be a lot of new bureaucracy for business, unfortunately, filling in customs declarations. And also there'll be checks. There'll be checks in the ports and airports. And so costs and delays, unfortunately, for business, but could have been a much worse situation if we ended up with tariffs and quotas. For citizens, again, very little in practice will change. We'll still be able to travel freely to Britain, live, work, study there. Other Europeans won't. That's a special arrangement that we have because of the Irish Protocol and the Common Travel Area. And British people will still be able to come here. In some ways, we'll have certain advantages as Ireland when we're looking for investment. We'll be able to say that if you set up your factory or your tech company or here in Ireland, you'll have access not just to the European market, but also the whole European labour market, which is really important too. There will probably be duty free, by the way, whenever we're able to start flying again. Yeah. There may well be duty free between Ireland and Britain. One thing they're out of, unfortunately, is Erasmus. So,
We've made an announcement in the last couple of days to safeguard the future of Northern Irish students when it comes to that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's something that that Simon Covey and I announced a long time ago, quite early on in the Brexit process. We said that we would do everything we could to make sure that people in Northern Ireland were not left behind. So we made a commitment that Northern Ireland residents don't have to be Irish or British citizens. Long-term Northern Ireland residents would continue to avail of Erasmus and we'd pay for it. And they'd also continue to avail of what's the equivalent of the European Health Insurance Card, the old D111. Mm. That doesn't apply to British residents.
So are they still able to qualify for that even if they're not attending an institution in the Republic? If they're going to Queen's or the University of Ulster, can they still pursue it for then? Or is it only if they're attending an institution in the Republic?
Yeah, well, institution in the European Union. Okay. So a lot of the details have to be worked out, but as I understand it, if a Northern Ireland resident who's studying, let's say, in Queen's or Ulster University decides to study in Paris or Rome or Lisbon, that we will cover the cost of that so that their rights aren't diminished. One thing that's interesting about Erasmus, and this is a small thing in many ways, is that a lot of Irish students attending Irish universities tend to do their Erasmus in England. And that option won't be there anymore. There might be some new arrangement, but it won't be Erasmus. We might do something bilaterally with them. And I think what it might encourage more Irish students to actually study in Spain and Germany and France, which actually would be a good thing in my view, because we're not the best on language competencies. And it might encourage more Irish students to study in continental Europe, which could be a plus.
This far removed, are you now at liberty to say what you said to Boris Johnson in The World to try and break that logjam so long ago?
Well, I'm not sure it was ever a secret, Gavin, but I can tell you. we had the meeting. It was a one-on-one meeting, and sometimes they're the ones that work the best. Tete-a-tete is the term the officials and diplomats like to use, which allowed him to explain what he needed and me to explain what we needed. He'd made a big issue around the backstop, that the backstop had to be removed. He liked to use the medical term backstopectomy. I'm not sure if that was for my benefit or whether it was just something he came up with himself. And what I said to him was, it's not the backstop we're hung up on, it's what the backstop does. And if there's another mechanism by which we can avoid a hard border between North and South, guarantee that we would not have to have physical infrastructure checks and controls, well, then I was up for that.
But it was seen as a bit of a capitulation on his part that he was so against the backstop or maybe perhaps what it was supposed to achieve. And then after the meeting, he went back and sold exactly the same deal that he said that no British Prime Minister could ever tolerate.
Well, it was different in two respects. One was that the backstop was replaced with a front stop, some people decided to call it. And the second was that Northern Ireland would stay in, the UK customs territory, if you like, but in practice, in many ways, still in the single market of the European Union and applying our customs rules. So I suppose it was a way to reposition and a way that we could both make certain concessions but still get the outcomes that we wanted. And what is crucial is that we're not going to have that hard border between North and South. The all-island economy is not going to be disrupted.
You're quoting the Sunday Independent today saying that you'd like to see the UK back as a member of the European Union someday. Might that be seen as inflammatory across the water when those are currently claiming victory after a 4.5 year long quest to try and make Brexit a reality?
I think if you see the totality of my remarks, I said that we acknowledge that they've left the European Union. That's their decision. Totally respect it. Don't want to be disrespectful of that in any way whatsoever. And I also said that I don't think they will rejoin. However, the option is always there. Any country that is part of Europe, including Britain, including the Western Balkans, for example, countries like Serbia, Macedonia, for example, the option is there for them to rejoin. And perhaps in the future, you'll see a UK government that wants a close relationship with the single market, that wants to go for something like the Norway model, for example, or perhaps in the future, through generational change, they may wish to rejoin, or we may even have a different Europe in 10 or 20 years time, with an inner Europe and outer Europe, who knows. But I think we should always say that the option is there and the invitation is there, while absolutely fully respecting their decision. Okay. That the decision is made and we respect that.
Before I move on to COVID, by the way, there's one other story in the Sunday Independent today, which is the junior minister in your government, Malcolm Noonan, the Minister for Heritage, saying that water charges could be revisited. I'd imagine that's a comment that could send a chill up a lot of political spines in government.
Well, I can confirm that the reintroduction of water charges is not in the programme for government, so it won't be happening under this government. What we are introducing is charges for people who waste water or use excess water, and that's coming into effect. But that's a very different thing.
But just because it's not in the programme for government, it doesn't mean it can't be discussed or put as alongside a referendum on safeguarding the ownership of the utility.
Oh, you know, anything can be discussed. You know, I'd be very frank with you. You know, I was part of a government that introduced water charges and was then part
You're
of a government
of
that abolished
them. Them again,
yeah. You know, from a personal point of view, I've never thought that water charges were a bad idea. You have to pay for electricity, you have to pay for gas, you know, has to be paid for. But the decision was made back under the last government that we wouldn't have water charges, and that was reaffirmed in the programme for government.
So not happening in the lifetime of this government?
No.
Okay. Talking about the COVID vaccine, there are a lot of people on Twitter and in print and a lot of other people in the public health sphere as well who are asking why, if we had our first delivery of COVID-19 vaccines yesterday, are we waiting until Wednesday to administer them?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure actually, Gavin, but what I'm told is it just takes a couple of days to organise things. And, you know, while you could have done a few people, if you like, in the initial days, that the authorities thought it was better, you know, to start on Wednesday and start it properly, if you like. So it is going to begin in earnest on Wednesday. We've 10,000 doses have arrived. We'll have roughly 40,000 doses arriving every week from January, and starting with people who live in long-term care facilities, nursing homes, and also staff who are working there and are exposed to patients.
We're not starting on them until January the 11th, and the batch that's being done this week is only a small number of older people who are in a small number of hospitals. It does make us look like we're on the back foot, because Israel, for example, claims that it's inoculating 1.1% of its population every day. They'll be finished in March. If you look at the United States, they're going to say that they've got 20 million doses administered by the first week of January. They seem to be racing ahead of us, so we're being really left as laggards here.
Well, I think we'll probably start a little bit slower, but catch up. And, you know, we're part of the European system. We get 1.11% of the vaccine, and that's a portion of our population. And I think we probably will start a little bit slower than other countries, but we will catch up. I don't see it as a race. I think it's important that we do it right.
No, but on what basis can you say we're going to catch up? Because I presume they're only outlining their timetables based on the same Pfizer vaccine that's already cleared in those markets. So how are they able to start quicker than we can?
Yeah, because more arrive. So we'd anticipate now that the Moderna vaccine will be approved on the 6th of January. That's not part of the current schedules we've seen in the papers today. So that'll bring in additionality already in the first half of January. And there seems to be a good chance that the AstraZeneca one will be approved by the end of January. And that's particularly important because we've pre-ordered a huge number of them, more so than we did for Pfizer. And also that one doesn't require deep cold chain. That's a more normal vaccine that you'd be used to using in GP surgeries and pharmacies. It only needs to be refrigerated. So the kind of scheme that you're seeing now in the papers looks slow, but it can be accelerated and will be accelerated as those other vaccines come online, assuming they do, but we are confident they will.
Do you regret reopening society quite so far in advance of Christmas, given that it has necessitated the reintroduction of measures from today where people can't travel across county boundaries? It seems as if people were promised something of a meaningful Christmas, and if they were sold 6 weeks of restrictions on the basis that it would secure Christmas, that was a bargain you didn't live up to.
Well, you know, any time I come into the studio to talk about COVID, I do so with a sense of humility, because this virus is forever making a fool of all of our plans. You know, we had a 6 week lockdown. It did work, and if you look back over the past 6 months, Ireland, along with maybe Finland and Iceland, has the lowest incidence of the virus, the lowest mortality rates. So what Irish society has done has been effective. We took the decision on the 1st of December with approval and advice from NPHET to ease restrictions, and we all thought at that time we'd get as far as January. You know, the modelling at the time was suggesting that if we did a 6-week lockdown, that we'd get numbers down very low and we'd be able to get as far as earlier mid-January. As it happened, the 6-week lockdown didn't work to the extent that we hoped it was would. It didn't get the numbers
well down. It worked to the extent that the government did, because you shifted the goalposts somewhat, because NPHET said they wanted the R number to be 0.5 for 6 weeks, but when the government adopted it, you said that all you wanted was for the R number to be below 1. And if NPHET's own theories for how knockdown was supposed to work had been applied, then we would have bought ourselves much more time and much more breathing space, and we might have been able to enjoy a full meaningful Christmas and New Year, and now we haven't, and it's partly because of the government deciding on a different interpretation.
No, I think that's a bit of revisionism there. You know, NPHET recommended that we ease restrictions, that we go from level 5 to level 3. They didn't say the 6 weeks was not enough. Let's go for a 7th week, let's go for an 8 week. So we followed the recommendation to ease restrictions on the 1st of December, which we did. The only difference was that they recommended that we don't open hospitality. We took the decision that we would. However, they did recommend that from the 1st of December, we should allow household visits of up to 4 households at a time. So had we followed their instructions to the letter, we wouldn't have had groups of 6 meeting up in a few thousand restaurants. We would have had much bigger groups meeting up to 2 million living rooms across Ireland. So would we be in a worse situation or a better situation or the same situation? Nobody knows the answer to that definitively. But what we can say definitively is that when you look at clusters and outbreaks, they are much more common in households than in hospitality settings, for obvious reasons, because there's a lot more households than there are hospitality settings. But what's true, whether it's the government or NPHET you want to go by, what is true is that nobody anticipated that the numbers would rise so quickly. And they did very dramatically, literally from the 14th or 15th of December, numbers rose
and
dramatically.
We now know that NPHET now wants non-essential retail to be shut as well. That was a recommendation you received just before Christmas. When are you going to consider that, and will you act on it?
Well, we have considered that already, and we took a decision not to do that. Of course, we'll review the situation again on the 29th of December when we have a cabinet meeting, and again in the new year. But bear in mind, the restrictions that we brought in will not show any effect until probably the 1st week or 2nd week of January. There is a kind of a 10 to 14 day lag from when you introduce restrictions to when it starts showing up and falling case numbers. So we would expect cases to continue to rise no matter what we do. Cases will continue to rise.
Given that cases
until the early new year.
And given that that's going to be the case, where the cases are going to rise until new year, and then the result of the Christmas period and people socialising in each other's homes will then kick in. Can we know for certain that schools will reopen in the 1st week of January, given that we could at that point be looking at daily case numbers of well over 2,000, perhaps approaching 3,000 per day?
You know what, like the plan is the schools will reopen as planned. You know, one thing that we learned from the pandemic, and we've learned as we go along, is that schools are relatively safe environments. There's no environment that's 100% safe unless you're 100% on your own, but they are relatively safe environments. And, you know, children in their pods are probably as safe there as they would be in any other scenario. And that's why schools will continue, will reopen as planned. I think when it comes to retail, it's important to bear in mind, and I watched the NPHET press conference very closely last week, and one point that they made was that the restrictions that were eased on the 1st of December, so that is non-essential retail, the 5 kilometre limit and so on, that only resulted in a small increase in cases. And they would attribute hospitality as the thing that led to the very large increase in cases, perhaps compounded by the new variant.
So the converse is also true. Allowing non-essential retail didn't add much, then it wouldn't remove much.
Yeah, logically, the converse is also true. So if NPHET and the evidence suggests that closing non-essential retail would only make a small difference in cases, then you have to ask, is it worth all the other consequences? And bear in mind, I think whatever restrictions we have in place now are going to be there for a prolonged period. Now we have the vaccine. It is being provided to those who need it most, healthcare workers and the medically vulnerable. And to me, it makes sense that we should not ease restrictions until we've got to the point where we have all those people vaccinated. Well, so when you're putting something in place for a prolonged period, you need to bear that in mind too.
But on that though, are we going to keep some sort of restrictions in place, even at lighter levels, until a critical mass of the whole population has received it, where you have 70% of the public at large? Or are we prepared to start releasing restrictions once the vast majority of those who are especially vulnerable, those who have underlying conditions, are vaccinated? Because one means that you can start to consider getting rid of restrictions permanently in February or March. The other means you might have to wait until the middle of the summer.
I don't think we'll be getting rid of restrictions permanently in February or March. You know, restrictions such as mass gatherings, for example, I don't see them happening until the summer at the earliest. But we will have to see how things develop. What we'd anticipate is that if a critical mass of people have the vaccine, you will see, first of all, you'll see the mortality rate fall, because if those most at risk of getting sick or dying are vaccinated, you will then see the case fatality rate and the incidence fatality rate falling. And that's the most important thing, because this is about saving lives.
Some midsummer, you think?
I think so, yeah. I think so. You know, certainly those restrictions on kind of, you know, gatherings of 50 people. Bear in mind, we allowed gatherings of 50 people during last summer, okay, at least up until August. I don't see that until the summer. I really don't. But, you know, we'll have to see how effective the vaccine is, okay, in terms of reducing cases and reducing mortality.
We'll have to leave it there. Tánaiste Liathracha, thank you very much for joining us this morning on The Record.